In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Wolfson History Prize, which has been awarded to standout history books since 1972. And as part of the celebrations, we've teamed up with the Wolfson Foundation to bring you some fascinating panel discussions on history's biggest topics. Today's panel focuses on the history of religion, and its chair, who introduced the discussion and the panelists, is Professor Dermot McCulloch.
The Wolfson Prize is as a prize for the best historical writing by writers in the UK, and it's been going now for 50 years. And during that time, religion, the subject of religion, has been a major part of what the history judges have honoured over the years. The very first book to win the Wolfson History Prize was about religion. It was the famous Religion and the Decline of Magic by Keith Thomas. Over the years, many other books have been winners when the subject has been religion. I name, for instance, a book by one of our panel here today, Heretics and Believers, which won the prize in 2018, Peter Marshall's book. We've had a book on Reformation, which I wrote myself. And this year, you can say that at least two of the six shortlisted books were absolutely focused on religion. One couldn't be more focused. It was God, An Anatomy by Francesca Stavrakopoulou. Besides that, we had Nicholas Orme, Going to Church in Medieval England. You see, it's religion. And the same thing goes back over the years. So that's a very good reason for us to be talking about religion today. It's a paradox, perhaps, because in this country, religion seems to be in decline. At least going to a place of religion seems to be in decline. So history is going to comment on that, but it may also point to the fact that in the world at large, religion is far from dead. It is extraordinarily lively in all its forms. To discuss all this, we have myself as chairman, Dermot McCulloch, Emeritus Professor of the History of the Church in Oxford University, Emeritus, in other words, I've retired, and I'm a Wolfson Prize judge. Besides that, we have Carol Hillenbrand, who is also a Wolfson Prize judge and Professor Emerita of Islamic History in the University of Edinburgh. We have Peter Marshall, who won the Wolfson History Prize in 2018, Professor of History in the University of Warwick. And we have Chakravarti Ramprasad, Distinguished Professor of Comparative Religion and Philosophy in the University of Lancaster. So I'll be stepping back and letting these three experts do most of the talking, but I will start them off with a question, a very broad question, which I think I'll start throwing at Peter Marshall in the first place. And this is, how has the writing of history about religion changed in the last 50 years?
Thanks, Dermot. Well, that's a very interesting question. It would take a long time to answer fully, I think. I mean, one thing that occurs to me straight away, which is good news for all of us on this panel, I guess, is that the history of religion is back and has become central to our understanding of the past in a way that perhaps would have surprised scholars in the decades just after the Second World War. when in the West, at least, or certainly in Western Europe, there was a sense that religion was being consigned pretty firmly to the past, and religious history looked a rather fuddy-duddy sort of subject. And if religion was important at all, it was, as I guess what Marxist historians might have called a kind of superstructure, you know, a frothy topping above more fundamental questions around social, political, economic power. And that has changed dramatically, I think. I would like to say that it doesn't have much to do with 9/11, but I fear it does for people in the West who weren't paying attention before that point. In the last 20 years, it's become very clear, as you mentioned in your introduction, that religion is far from dead or moribund across the wider world once we, you know, look over our own garden fence in Western Europe. And that perhaps religion needs to be taken seriously on its own terms. Religious belief is not necessarily something that we can simply translate into concepts that the more secular among us find easier to understand.
Thanks, Peter. Ram, could I ask you to follow up on that?
Yes, I think to a large extent, the question itself relies on what the distinction between the secular and the religious is. And that arises from a very particular history of the concept of religion in the academy, perhaps especially in the 20th century. So if you look at, say, India, after independence, history writing was assiduously committed to this rigorous distinction between what was declared religious and what was thought to be secular. But to a large extent, from perhaps the 1960s, perhaps more in the American universities, later on in Britain as well, a certain amount of pressure was put on what seemed like an artificial distinction born out of a very particular history of Western modernity. So if you look at India and the absolute riotous pluralism of its religious traditions, the conceptual question of even what Hinduism is and how many religions might constitute that, the constant interaction over the past 1,000 years between Islam and the other Indic traditions, when you look at how the subcontinent is a home to almost all the major religious traditions in the world, you look at literature, you look at the way polities were formed, you look at the interactions with British colonialism and the independence movement later on. In every place, it seemed like when we were talking about the structures of society, when we're thinking about culture, we think of literary outputs, we think about rethinking the past, what was artificially hived off as religion did not seem to be able to stay away. So I think in the last 50, 60 years, at least in Western scholarship, there has been a lot of pressure put on thinking that religion should be considered out with the disciplinary domains of history. Now, that's become very interesting, important, urgent with the rise of certain forms of Islamist thinking in Pakistan and Bangladesh, with the rise of Hindu nationalism in India, with the clashes during the Sri Lankan civil war of Buddhist Sinhala nationalism in Sri Lanka. So all over the subcontinent, religion was consciously brought into political calculation through, interestingly enough, a very modern conception of religion as having a particular kind of role, either antagonistic to or integral to the modern nation state. So that's brought even greater urgency, an urgency to do with not only academic ideas, but the very transformation of society to the connection between the category of religion and the category of history.
Thanks, that's very helpful. Carol, can I bring you in now on that same question?
I would like to answer this question by discussing the work of recent historians on the religion of Islam. A good example is how the Arab conquests of 632 to 732 have been reinterpreted. By 732, the Muslim armies were in France, on the Indus, and on the borders of China. The traditional view was that this seismic phenomenon was inspired by religion. But was it? The irreversible desiccation of the fertile lands of Yemen pushed large populations in Arabia northwards by a domino effect into Syria and Iraq. Centuries of warfare between the Romans and the Persians had left both these empires exhausted, and they were unable to counter the Arab advance. So economic and political factors were also at play. The Arab conquests involved factors other than religion. Here's another test case, this time based on my own research. Up to about 1950, the Crusades were seen in the West overwhelmingly from the Western European point of view. The other side was virtually ignored. In 1999, I published a long book based on medieval primary sources in Arabic, which told a very different story. That book has proved a wake-up call to Western historians, encouraging them to investigate hitherto unexplored approaches to these religious wars, which were also early examples of European colonialism.
Very helpful. And straight away from all these three contributions, we see how political the subject of religion is. Over at least 1,500 years, as we tell our stories, we are rewriting the present, aren't we? Do you think that our efforts are welcome to those in politics? Ram, what you think about that?
I just wanted to say, before we think of those in politics, maybe those who might be in politics in 20 years' time, I teach about the relationship between concept of holy war and just war in Christian and Islamic traditions, of course, use Carroll's work. And the 20-year-olds who come to these classes over the last maybe half a decade or so are so sensitive, so ready to understand how public discourse, what the media presents, what politicians sort of polemically hold forth on, are really problematic, are based on concepts that were problematic 50 or 60 years ago. And it's been really one of the most sort of optimism-inducing experiences I've had teaching about the wider relationship between religion and violence, and having these young people, the political leaders of tomorrow, really willing to deconstruct this public discourse. And I really hope there's a seismic shift in how the language of the role of religion plays out on the national scene with the coming generation, and the kind of systematic work that, you know, Carroll did over a generation, I hope is really beginning to bear fruit with a new group of students who are willing to challenge the ideologies that have dominated, as Peter was pointing out, since, of course, 9/11.
I mean, I think one thing that we've got straight away to in our conversation, without perhaps being explicitly asked to comment on it, is what we mean by religion. I mean, I think one of the problems is that people hear that word and it brings with it a great bundle of assumptions about what it actually means. And one of the things I think we as historians can do is really bring home the extent to which religion is a moving target. It has meant different things at different times, and even within the historical profession itself. I mean, in my own field in the history of Christianity, I guess 50 or 60 years ago, what I do would have been called ecclesiastical history, something rather different. I mean, Dermot, you edited for many years a wonderful journal, the Journal of Ecclesiastical History. But, you know, the work which has been published there and in other places now is a much broader definition of religion, which encompasses culture, ideology, lived religion. Has become something of a buzz phrase among historians. So the historiography of previous generations, at least in the history of Christianity, it may have been different in other fields, was one that was focused very much on great men. They nearly always were men, Thomas Aquinas, Luther, et cetera, et cetera. It was interested in doctrine. It was interested in institutions. And it was something that, you know, could easily be sort of abstracted and set aside, and sometimes indeed, and still is in other parts of Europe, be studied and researched in separate university departments of ecclesiastical history, let's say. So I think this is a rather good thing, although, of course, it's a challenge to all of us, is that religion has become extraordinarily messy. It has bled into all sorts of other areas of investigation, where, of course, it always was, but it's taken us some time to see that.
One of the interesting things is about the presentation of what Christianity means and what Islam means in any sort of monolithic way in broadly the West, certainly the media in Western Europe, Britain, America, and so forth. And that's got to do with resolutely ignoring the internal diversity of all these traditions. And if with Islam, of course, it is absolutely skewing its presentation to narrow, ideological, highly hostile, Islamophobic sort of political trends. With Christianity, it is treating non-Western Christianity really as an other, sometimes as if it were as baffling as the most mysterious of you know, non-Christian ideas from the rest of the world. Also, it's a way in which I've often struggled to see the way in which the specialization on the history and the doctrines of Christianity in the West don't seem to at all be sensitive to, for example, the long history of Christianity in India. I mean, it pretty much goes back to the early century, if not the first century of the Christian era. But certainly when you look at the range of doctrinal commitments, as well as the really subtle and complex interplay between Christianity in India with larger Hindu cultural trends, you have ideas about pluralism, for example, ideas of layered identities, ideas about the relationship between language and liturgy, which simply will not be found if you keep going back to the history of Western Christianity. Not saying that that's not a perfectly legitimate endeavor, but when it comes to thinking about religion globally, sometimes it seems to me that at least the bafflement towards Hinduism or Sikhism or Jainism is honest. The assumption of knowledge about world Christianity is often really problematic because it doesn't get to the existential worldviews. These are often studied in terms of political framings in kind of economic context. But in terms of cultural identities, in terms of doctrinal innovations, I think Christianity is as misunderstood in the West as Islam or Hinduism.
I think that's absolutely right. And you know, as a historian of the Reformation, I think the Reformation has a lot to answer for here in all sorts of ways. I have the sense that the Reformation fixes in the Western mind that religion is primarily doctrinal or propositional. It's about belief. The 16th, 17th century is the great age of catechisms and confessions and, you know, what do you believe? You know, people who perhaps now don't practice religion in the West, they still know, you know, that's what religion is. You know, we had all those rather tiresome debates in the, you know, first decade of this century between the so-called new atheists and their opponents about, you know, whether or not, you know, religious claims were true and how that could be demonstrated. And of course, belief is important and it's crucial to identity. But I think, you know, certainly in the wider world, as Ram is saying, but even in Christian Europe, you know, for most of the time, religion has been about, you know, doing rather than you know, believing particular propositions. I've always been rather taken with the formula of Karen Armstrong, very influential writer on religion, that you know, religion is really it's like swimming. It's, you know, a practical art. You just have to sort of jump in and get on with it. And, you know, Ram may have a view on this and Carol as well, but my suspicion is that a particular view of what religion or a religion is formed in Europe at the time of the Reformation, largely in Northern Europe out of a sense of Protestant triumph at the Reformation. So a religion is a set of true doctrines and of right forms of behavior supported by a holy book out of which these things can be demonstrated, and which is rather obsessed with notions of purity and heresy or deviance. And even in Europe, I mean, the Reformation fails in its attempt to, make religion pure and unmessy and about, formative types of belief. But I sense that kind of template is one that we have inherited as our way of understanding religion. And, perhaps as historians, what we can say to a secular society in the West is that, no, there are other ways of thinking about what religion has meant and does mean to people, which are not simply about, I believe this stuff, which is true, and you don't.
What I do want to say is actually go back to something I briefly said about the history of the study of religion in relation to history in post-colonial India, is the extent to which that the high ideology of the Reformation became more or less the house philosophy of academia around the world, so that historians in India, as much as in South Africa or in Taiwan or wherever, and I would think too in parts of the Arab world, that had so internalized the, for good or for bad, the crystallization of the diversity of religious life in terms of having to adhere to a particular set of doctrinal facts, that if they did not see it in that way, then it ceased to become an object of study. And in ceasing to be an object of study, it was sort of with relief that a lot of, for example, Marxist historians turned away and said, we don't need to look at these phenomena anymore. We can look at underlying socio-political and economic trends and get at the history of people. Or you could swing the other way and say, perhaps not so much in academy as, for example, in religious leadership, to say religion really is this set of facts, these sets of commitments, and we're going to try and politicize what religious belonging means. So there is this real sort of bifurcation into whether you ignore religion because you think it's a bunch of doctrines and you stop studying it, or you go in search of identifying your religious identity through these sort of these doctrinal commitments, these sort of epistemic workings in your brain, and try and remold society politically through such commitments. But both of those things turn on, I think, a consequence of the Reformation's conceptualization of religion. It becomes really one of the driving machines of European modernity to think of religion in this way, whether you want to manipulate it or whether you want to ignore it.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Historical experts have a role to play, and history is too important to be left to people who have an agenda.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Carol, Peter and I are both historians of the Reformation, and so we've got a clash about a sacred book. Now, Islam is very much, if not more than Christianity, about a sacred book. But where does it go from there? Where does its history take it, which makes it unlike this sort of Protestant Christian template that historians have tended to impose on it?
Well, it's about history. It's about what happened. And we need to use our judgment and imagination to interpret such facts, in inverted commas, as we have. I've certainly realised that the past has impacted and continues to impact on the present for Muslims. Modern Islam, practiced by 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide, rests on the foundation of a series of events widely accepted as historical. That's especially true of the early period in the 7th century, when Muhammad and his immediate followers lived. They experienced violent schisms. So, for example, the killing of the Prophet's grandson Hussein in 680 in a battle between two opposing groups who held different views about who should rule is a hinge of history for modern Shiites. They, unlike Sunni Muslims, believe that members of the Prophet's own family should rule the Islamic community. These ancient disputes between Sunnis and Shiites have traction today. How much of the world knows about the difference? Non-Muslims, how many of them have really gone into this detail? Now, look, for example, at Iran. A Shiite state cannot agree with Sunni Saudi Arabia. That's history that makes sense of this religious conflict. And I could go on about religion in the Muslim world, which is viewed in a way not paralleled by most of the postmodern West. Just think of Ramadan, the month when Muslims en masse fast, and the pilgrimage to Mecca every year, which unites Muslims from right across the globe. These are only two examples of how religion has defined Muslim society for well over 1,000 years. Everyday piety, daily prayers, going to the mosque on Friday, charitable giving. That is, if I may use a literary expression, the warp and weft of much of Muslim society even today.
One thing that occurs to me that, again, perhaps, you know, we as scholars and historians can say to society about this, is that fundamentalism, certainly in Christianity, and I guess perhaps in Islam and Hinduism too, which, you know, is often seen in the West as a kind of bizarre preserved residue of a distant past, is actually in some ways a fundamentally modern phenomenon in all the world religions. And that over the wider sweep of history, religious practice has been more diverse, more pluralistic, much more locally rooted, sometimes not always more tolerant, but certainly more complex than the kind of fundamentalists of modernity and their different traditions, you know, would want us all to believe. And, you know, at the risk of sounding rather pious about this, I think historians of religion, you know, can help adherents of faiths and others, you know, recover a broader and wider grasp of what religion means, what religion can do, than just the self-appointed spokespeople in these traditions might offer us.
Yeah, I'd like to intervene, though I'm supposed to be chairman on that one, because within Christianity, there is now an enormous debate about marriage. And it's not just about whether two people of the same sex can get married. It's about the role of marriage in Christianity. But I don't hear Christian leaders telling Christians in the West that there was no such thing as a liturgical service of marriage within Christianity until in Eastern Christianity in the 7th century and in Western Christianity as late as the 11th century. Now, if you say that, you didn't go to church to get married. Clergy didn't have anything to do with that. That's injecting a very subversive element into the story which Christians want to tell about themselves now.
I mean, I think that's a great way of focusing. It's what do people want to say now about what their religion is? And I mean, I'm sure we all keep having these experiences one way or the other, which is how to negotiate the reluctance, at least, and often the outright hostility of people from the traditions we work with when we tell them, you know, this is what the texts actually say. This is what the traditions have done. Where are you getting this legislative perspective on the tradition from? And, you know, you're saying, but yes, it's, we want to, you know, you don't want to feel pious about it, but you could certainly get drawn into the battle that questions what your role is in being an academic. And of course, there is a further question of whether in some sense you come out of that tradition or you have that background or not, and I'm sure. But it's almost as if it's impossible to be committed to the study of religion today and try and explain to the best of our abilities what its history is and, you know, how it's developed and what its bearings are on today without coming up against what people want to say about themselves now, and that fundamental ahistoricity that informs this so-called fundamentalism.
Peter, do you want to follow up on that?
Gosh, I mean, we're all sort of in agreement on this one, aren't we?
Right.
You know, tradition is often wielded as a political weapon or as a cultural weapon by people with a vested interest in doing so. And one of the things, of course, you discover, you know, very early, even as an undergraduate studying history, is that all traditions are invented in one way or another. And, you know, things that seem like immemorial custom turn out to be things our grandparents did. And, you know, their grandparents, you know, did things sort of, you know, completely differently, you know. So even things that seem within Christian tradition, I mean, to pick a sort of frivolous example, playing organs in churches, you know, which seems like the epitome of a timeless Christianity, is, of course, a 19th century innovation, which would have seemed very strange to people in the century before that. So I suppose that, you know, again, at the risk of being pious, you know, one doesn't want sort of maliciously as a historian to try and, you know, undermine people's beliefs with clever arguments about how it wasn't so. But I think, you know, we can encourage people to look at the broader sweep and to understand how religious traditions have changed. And of course, all religious traditions have changed. And sometimes those changes have been violent and traumatic. And the Reformation or the Crusades are perhaps preeminent examples of that. But sometimes change has been managed more successfully, and things that you know, would have seemed unimaginable for adherents of a faith tradition to accept, actually, within a generation or two, it turns out, you know, they can accept them. And that includes, of course, many of the changes we're very familiar with in the West around marriage and sexuality and gender. Though, of course, some of us may think there's quite a lot of work still to do in those areas.
It seems to me that we're rather coming back to our very first question. How has the writing of history changed in the last 50 years? Well, it seems to me that in virtually all our cases as historians of religion, we have been part of a process of stepping back from the religions which we study to look at them and walk around them in ways which historians might not have done before that.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Hinduism, but perhaps most non-Christian traditions, I think the movement has also been more complicated in the fact that colonial scholarship glorified in the distance it placed between the historian and normally his subject, exactly at the time when it was pretty dramatic, pretty radical to be doing so with Christianity, and not unthinkingly, as it were, speak from within. So to some extent, one understands why post-colonial subjects want to have the right, as it were, the political right, the historical right, to say, we want to speak from within our traditions. And, you know, in a sense, almost to say, why is it that only we are condemned for the blind spots we have because of our belonging? So that makes the scholars of these traditions, puts them, whether they are from those countries or whether they have their origin in those countries and work in the West, where most of the work gets done anyway, puts them in a very odd position, because you simultaneously want to say, yes, there is a need to speak without apology for the traditions from which one comes, but at the same time to do so with a critical sense of belonging. And oddly enough, what happens is you end up, for example, with me, talking to fellow Indians to say, you do realize that the narrative of the politics of Christianity is challenged by Christian scholars in the West. It's okay to do that. Whereas what happens is you're still in a cycle in which, at least in India or South Asia, Hindu or Muslim scholars are just arriving at the point where they say, we want to be like how Christian scholars were 100 years ago and unapologetically speak from within our tradition. So these kind of historical layers coexisting at the same time when it comes to what the history of religion should be in terms of the relationship between the scholar and their material.
Peter?
I think that's really interesting, Ram, and I recognise, I think, a lot of what you're saying. I mean, I have to admit to being a little bit conflicted about this, because certainly in the history of Christianity, going back half a century or longer, this was largely confessional history. I guess you could call it, ancestor worship in a sense. It was tracing the development of particular traditions in order to, privilege them and protect them. And I don't think any of us or many of us lament that is no longer the case. But I'm a little wary of us, swinging to the other end of the pendulum dramatically and saying that, actually, religion can only be studied effectively from a position of, total, usually secular detachment. And I'm going to, controversially say here and annoy half our listeners that secularism is also a faith commitment, which, needs to be interrogated in the same way as religion. And the question, of course, we never want to ask ourselves as historians of religion, is any of it true? And I'm not proposing to answer that question now. In some ways, I think it's a question as historians we can avoid by saying that what we have to do with our historical subjects is respect their beliefs, try and understand them on their own terms, and not necessarily just translate them into concepts that are, easier to understand for us. But the question of whether historians of religion can be trusted with their own faith traditions, I think is worth asking. From my own point of view, I think they can, but not always. And sometimes the external critical eye is needed, and sometimes the eye of empathy and experience, brings something to that the external eye doesn't necessarily see.
Mm-hmm. Carol?
Well, I feel that the reading of the interactions and relationships between religions over time brings us to perhaps the issue of interfaith, which is really quite prevalent at the moment. Looking back in Islamic history, as I have done, of course, the classic case of interfaith engagement is really very interesting, that of Muslim Spain, traditionally known as the land of the three religions. And in early medieval times, traditionally in one Spanish city after another, for example, Cordoba and Seville, Jews and Christians had their own quarters in a predominantly Muslim society. They even had a degree of self-government as well as freedom of worship. All they were required to do was to pay a special tax. Medieval Christian Europe offered nothing of comparable generosity, as far as I know, to so-called infidels. So what can we learn, as we said in the question that was given to us by Dermot, what can we learn from this kind of practical kind of tolerance when significant and growing Muslim minorities are extending their reach now in Europe? South Asians in the UK, North Africans in France, Turks in Germany, Indonesians in Holland. No longer are Muslims, in inverted commas, over there. They're now right here, enjoying the legal requirement to be treated as equal citizens. So I'd like to draw some comfort from the example of nations that have experimented boldly and sometimes successfully with creating frameworks for groups of differing religious persuasions to live together relatively in peace. Lebanon, for example, has a system where political power and government posts are shared equally between Christians and Muslims. And on a much larger scale, India is an ongoing experiment in the coexistence of multiple faiths. Several African countries, such as Ethiopia and Nigeria, have had to forge social structures that permit similar coexistence between Muslims and Christians. And this kind of activity, this strange and interesting interactive aspect between the religions is something which one can go right back to and learn from. The three monotheistic faiths are very much more together and similar to each other than many people in one of those three to understand properly.
Anyone like to take that further?
Well, I was just thinking that, I mean, again, returning to the task of the historian, we have to obviously try not to idealize the past, but we are drawn to particular times, you know, Cordoba or the Mughal court under Akbar and so forth, where we do look at political settlements which, however briefly and for whatever fragile period of time, held together the coexistence of a diversity of traditions and peoples. And I think even the most specific, most focused study of a particular figure, of a particular movement, of a particular city, calls upon historians to never flinch from saying, look, actually, the place of religion in the world and in humanity's history is messy. And that messiness is an irreducible plurality of coexistence. But today, it's a moral task of historians, and I don't care if I sound pious about it, to keep confronting politicians, media, people from within the traditions, people from outside the traditions, old people, students, to say, you know, religion's place in history is messy, and that's something that is of immense importance to us today.
It seems to me that our conversation is moving to a very important conclusion, which is that all four of us within this podcast would be extremely unpopular and in extreme physical danger in many circumstances in the world. I mean, Peter and I, for instance, as historians of Christianity, would be very unwelcome in Putin's Russia. We'd also be very unwelcome in Christian nationalist circles in the United States. What do we make of this thought? We are dangerous people, and we are people in danger as historians of religion.
Well, I've had one or two cross emails, but that's about as far, I think, as sort of my, you know, my personal endangerment has gone. Yes, I'd like to think so. Gosh, I mean, this does sound pompous, doesn't it? But, you know, speaking truth to power, perhaps historians can sometimes do that. Or to put it another way, I mean, we live in an age which famously is disparaging experts of all kinds. And, you know, one of the things that has always seemed to me rather wonderful about history is that it doesn't entirely belong to the experts, and its language and its concepts and its methods are explicable and, you know, can be practiced by a very wide range of people. But nonetheless, you know, historical experts have a role to play, and, you know, history is too important to be left to people who have an agenda you know, sometimes have to be challenged on the facts and the interpretations. And I think, you know, where we have this, you know, potentially very explosive interaction of religion and identity and nationalism and power. You know, that's a particularly important task. So I'm going to drag this back slightly to the Reformation again in an attempt to find some sort of, you know, good news from that angle. But I mean, the Reformation, of course, is this zero-sum game. It's this clash of fundamentals. You know, it's absolute. There is a right way and there is a wrong way to worship God. And it involves both, you know, legalized and informal forms of persecution and violence almost everywhere. And yet, in the end, neither side could win. And out of it, through the wonderful law of unintended consequences, in Western Europe at least, did emerge forms of religious pluralism which did not immediately lead to secularization or the marginalization of religious faith. And, you know, local accommodations of having to live alongside people and sometimes indeed intermarry with them who had different notions about truth and faith and practice just about everywhere on different timescales that happened. To give a very sort of, you know, parochial example of this, you know, Roman Catholics in Britain who are doing something entirely illegal in the 16th century and can be persecuted for it, and who face various forms of legal and social persecution up to, let's say, you know, the early 19th century, have now more or less, sometimes it's uncomfortable, but found their place within British society and even with the sort of establishment levels of British society. And of course, every particular case is different. But it may be that in Britain, at least, the way that the Christian traditions have, with great difficulty, learned to live alongside each other, you know, suggests how interfaith relations may develop in the coming decades.
Last thoughts from either Carol or Ram.
I mean, history reminds us, and we need reminding, that the world wasn't always secular in its outlook and inspiration and daily life as it now is in the West. And certainly, history also reminds us of the excesses that have all too often been associated with religious fanaticism. And it's horribly alive today, grabbing today's headlines in Afghanistan, for example, and in Yemen, and being ever aware of the past and the wonderful attitudes that have sometimes been apparent in interfaith negotiations and so on. It'll help us to guard against repeating the mistakes of our ancestors if we use some of our historical knowledge to help us.
Ram.
I just wanted to say I've had Muslim scholars of my generation or younger speak about the continuing impact of Carol's work. There is an important sense in which, and I feel that with Hinduism too, some of the best work gets done precisely when belonging and not belonging. Pluralism and speaking for oneself, speaking for others, objectivity, looking back at the past with distance, looking back at the past with passion, all of these things work together. And I think it is the resistance to tearing apart who's inside and who's outside, who looks at the past from within and who looks at it from about outside, who looks at it objectively or clinically, who thinks of it as a passionate statement of their own existential conviction. If they're held together, we have, in a way, a good historical culture. When they're torn apart and become challenges to each other's ways of looking, then that's when we are in trouble.
Well, listeners, you now know what historians of religion do. We keep you sane. And actually, we also enjoy it. And this has been such an enjoyable conversation. I'm so grateful to Ram and Carol and Peter for joining us today. And I hope that you too have enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.